Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to The Writer's Block with Jim Christina and Bobby Bell, right here on LA Talk Radio.
It is 8 o'clock. It's Thursday evening. This is LA Talk Radio, and you're listening to The Writer's Block. I am your host, Jim Christina, and sitting in the studio tonight with us is the 2015 winner of the Bill Wiley Award, recognition of their support of Western music and the Western way of life, Bobby Jean and Jim Bell.
It's great to be back.
We've missed you. You've been gone for so long.
I know. And we had a concert. You had a great interview. We've had Thanksgiving.
I know.
And here we are. We're in December. Can you believe it?
Yeah, I know. We have three more shows, counting this one, for this year, and then we're done.
Yeah. I know. And we did miss being here. Jim and I really enjoyed the 2 weeks that we were away. We had Adrienne Brennan, known as the Buckaroo Girl, in concert.
Right.
Our final concert of the year. And we certainly enjoyed Thanksgiving. Do you have a good Thanksgiving?
I did. We did the traditional, I forgot, we had food. Prime rib. That's what we had.
Ah, and we did. What did we do, Jim?
Quarter
hens. Oh, women, here.
Turn his mic on.
Quarter hens.
There you go. The voice of Jim Bell.
There he is.
He's, first time speaking on.
He's not just holding up his chair any longer. You want me to keep that on for you?
Turn it off.
Okay.
So, yes, it's hard to believe that we're already, here we are.
Yeah, we started this in April, May. Mm-hmm. Yeah, May 21st, and here we are. We've done this is our 28th show.
And Jerry, your wife, who keeps the schedule, has been working crazy.
Yeah.
Already booking through, what did you tell me?
Third week in April.
In April.
Right.
So if you're listening and you're an author, a songwriter, a blogger, a publicist, a columnist, and you want to get on the show, how do they let Jerry know?
They can email her at guestwb@yahoo.com, and she'll respond in kind.
Yep.
That's what they do.
And use our Facebook page. Writer's Block Radio Show.
That's it. Which we have 600 and...
Yes, and we've had lots and lots and lots of views, and we would encourage, again, if you are anybody that has to do with the written word, please let us know what's going on. If you just published a book, you're going to be on an interview. You've just been written about. Why not go there and let us know about it?
We're fun people. We don't smell bad, so come on and visit us. If you want to call in tonight, talk to tonight's guest, and I'm going to let Bobby introduce him here in just a moment. He actually is sitting in our studio. The number here is 818-602-4929, 818-602-4929, and the Writer's Block is brought to you by Black Dog Publishing and Out West Boutique and Cultural Center in Newhall, California, of course owned and operated by Bobby and Jim Bell, who are also sitting here in the studio tonight. Okay, Bobby, take it away.
Okay, so I'm excited to introduce our guest for tonight. Tonight, we ride with Joe Harrington, the campfire storyteller, on a journey of wisdom of the West. Although he calls the Santa Clarita Valley of California home, he travels all over the West and beyond, participating in cowboy gatherings, festivals, and storytelling poetry events. He's a novelist, a cowboy poet, and a Western storyteller, and recognizing his talent, the Western Music Association nominated him for the 2013 Male Poet of the Year. Homespun and authentic, Joe's poems and stories follow the traditions of great storytellers. His stories and characters not only entertain, but they prod the soul with a truer understanding of the deep values and solid character of the American cowboy. a true gentleman who lives his life with a deep love for the Lord, his country, community, and family. Please welcome to the Writer's Block the Prairie Sage, Joe Harrington.
Thank you, Bobby.
I had to do that.
Makes it sound like everybody's in this.
I know, huh? Business. We have to tell them to settle down from time to time. They get way too loud.
We're so excited to have you with us. And I know you and Jim and I, of course, have worked together over several years at the Buckaroo Bookshop, Santa Cruz Cowboy Festival. And I think the first thing is just to tell us a little bit about yourself, Joe, and your background and where your stories come from.
Okay, well, I grew up at the feet of storytellers. My grandfather and my uncles just talked in stories, and there was just nothing better. I had 27 first cousins, and many of us would work. There were a number of ranches in the family, and we would all kind of work at the different ranches. And so when I would be in Laredo or George West or at one of the ranches in the evenings when the work was done, sitting around the fireplace with my uncle or my grandfather in the rocking chair, that was the greatest thing. But we never saw a television in those days. In fact, I never saw a television until I was out of elementary school. But sitting around listening to the stories, and I thought that everybody had that joy. Mm-hmm. But I found out later that, no, it was very unique, and I was deeply blessed to... to be able to sit at the feet of such amazing storytellers and hear stories that developed my character, because those people were amazing people. Their character was as solid as steel. I mean, they taught me all of my life lessons, and I didn't really realize that until later in life when I had all that to think back on. But so I appreciated stories just simply because it was the most entertaining thing to do in the evenings. And listening to their stories were magnificent. I mean, listening to my grandfather talk about the first time that he saw the Alamo from peeking out from underneath the canvas of a covered wagon. And stories like that. I know when my brother got orders for Vietnam, he went over to Vietnam on a ship. And my grandfather said, "So, Mike, how long did it take you to get there?" And Mike said, 28 days. And my grandfather said, "You know, it took me 28 days to go from Jacksboro down to San Antonio in a wagon." And so, you know, he was just astonished by that. But then years later, when I was in the Army, I was a drill sergeant at Fort Knox, Kentucky. And before I got my overseas orders, the scoutmaster there in the battalion got orders for Vietnam. And at the time, I had been working with an orphanage on weekends over in Indiana. And the sergeant major, battalion sergeant major, knew that. And so he came down and said, "Sergeant, the scoutmaster just got orders for Vietnam, so you are the new scoutmaster. You've got 100 boys. Show up tonight." That's just the way it happens. Fortunately, the Army was a big supporter of the Boy Scouts of America. So I showed up, and every event that we had, they supplied a bus, a driver, a truck, and they supplied a two-story barracks for us to have our meetings in. And I had 100 boys. But, boy, they were good kids. They were well-behaved kids. You could imagine 100 boys today in this environment.
No.
It'd be, forget it. But
you'd
these
have
good
to
kids.
Frisk them for weapons.
And I had a lot of support, I mean, because the Army really loved this program. And so anyway, we were going to go on a camporee. And I'd been a scoutmaster now for 6 or 8 months, and so I told the boys, here's the brochure for the campery, and look, they've got a storyteller. I was so excited that they had a storyteller, and because suddenly I remembered the fondness that I listened to stories. And so I played it up real big to the boys, and this is going to be great. You're going to love this. We got to the campery, and the guy was awful. He was just wretched. And I thought, this is not storytelling. I can't believe this. But I had built it up, and so I said, I thought, I'm going to have to start telling these boys stories. I mean, I never considered myself a storyteller, but I could certainly do better than what I just saw because I knew what storytelling was. And so I started telling the boys stories. And it wasn't long before we could not leave a meeting without stories. And then pretty soon the parents started coming to all the campouts, and they'd say, you know, we want to hear the stories. And it went on like that for until I left Fort Knox. And then when I picked up another, I got out of the Army and came back to the States from Korea, and I picked up another troop in San Diego, and then later another troop in Santa Clarita. But in every instance, the stories were the big things. The boys wanted the stories. And then after I'd been a scoutmaster in Santa Clarita for about 8 years, I'd been a scoutmaster for 25 years total, but after about 8 years, some of the parents started saying, you know, why don't you write this stuff down? So that's when I thought, well, yeah. And so I took one of the stories that I had developed for the boys, and it turned into this novel, Tocoa. I just began to live that story, and it turned into that novel. But I finally found out that people would pay to listen to my stories. And so I continued to tell those stories to public and to different venues, and I started doing conventions and festivals. And then my brother, who lives in Texas, back at the home place, got into cowboy poetry in a big way. And he said, you know, you really need to listen to some of this stuff because I think your stories would work very well in this genre. So I listened to it and I thought, you know, he's right. I could put my stories right into this stuff. And so I started writing that, and I fell in love with it. And I really liked doing cowboy poetry. It seemed to be a perfect fit for my kind of stories. And I really enjoyed doing it. And then I found out that I really enjoyed performing it. I never could find myself performing other people's work, just like I could never tell somebody else's story. But I like writing my life and the things that I learned. And then I realized, mostly I guess through the Boy Scouts, that today's young people need to hear life lessons of character and honor and integrity. And I learned all those things growing up from the people that told me stories. And so I decided that my stories really needed to be about the life lessons I learned, sometimes the embarrassing ways I had to learn them, sometimes the cost that it cost to learn them, the people I hurt to learn them, but they were lessons that needed to be passed on. Mm-hmm. And so that's, all of my stories just kind of focus on that now.
Mm-hmm. Wow. I'm mesmerized. And I'm never quiet.
Well, speaking about cowboy poetry, for those who aren't familiar with that, the genre, can you share a little bit about where the roots of cowboy poetry came from?
Well, you know, cowboys were always storytellers. I found that my uncles mm-hmm. and grandfather, they were the old original cowboys, and they loved to tell stories. And in the evenings around the campfires, when the guys were on the trail, it was sort of an obligation to entertain one another, and they would tell stories. And they would run out of stories. And so they'd start telling some of the same stories over and over. Maybe they'd get a little bit more embellished the next time around. But people got tired of hearing the same old stories. But suddenly they realized when they put the stories to rhyme and rhythm, nobody got tired of listening to them. They would listen to those same stories over and over again. And so that's really the way it got started. And I think you'll find that that's the case today. People, they're drawn to the rhythm of it. And when you have a good story and it's told to a rhythm, it's interesting. A lot of times people don't even know they're listening to a poem. They mm-hmm. don't have mm-hmm. a clue. It's just suddenly, wow, you know, they're just clicked in and they don't really know why, but part of that rhythmic nature of it is it has the same magic that music does.
Mm-hmm.
Not to the same level music does, but it has that same magic of just hooking you in.
Well, I think when we have a favorite song, we could hear it over and over and over again.
Oh, absolutely.
We totally know it, and I think that poetry is that same way.
Yeah, well, why don't we listen to some, and we can do that. We're going to be listening to Drinking from My Saucer, probably on the floor after New Year's Eve.
No.
That's not the reason. Here's Joe Harrington and Drinking from My Saucer.
I never made a fortune, and I guess it's too late now. But I don't worry about that much. I'm happy anyhow, 'cause as I go along life's journey, I'm reaping better than I sow. And I'm drinking from my saucer, 'cause my cup is overflowed. Don't have a lot of riches, and sometimes the going's tough. But I got four kids that love me, and that makes me rich enough. So I just thank God for His blessings and the mercy He's bestowed. And I'm drinking from my saucer, 'cause my cup has overflowed. Oh, I remember times when things went wrong and my faith got a little bit thin. But all at once, the dark clouds broke and that old sun peeked through again. So, Lord, help me not to gripe about the tough roads that I've hoed. I'm drinking from my saucer, 'cause my cup is overflowed. And if God grants me strength and courage when the way grows steep and rough, I'll not ask for other blessings. I'm already blessed enough, 'cause He pours out His richest offering and gives me more than I can hold. And I'm drinking from my saucer, 'cause my cup is overflowed. And may I always show I'm grateful in all I do and say. May I prove my love and kindness to those I meet each day. And may I never be too busy to help another bear his load. Then I'll keep drinking from my saucer, and my cup will overflow.
All right, settle down.
I love that piece.
Is that you doing the their accompaniment?
No, that's not me. Howard Yearwood out of Nashville did that. And Howard worked with me on this entire album. And it was delightful for both of us, really. I lay down a bunch of scratch tracks and just ideas, musical ideas. And I said, Howard, just have fun with this. Mm-hmm. And he just lit up. You mean I don't have to follow any structure? And I said, no, it just kind of improvise. Mm-hmm. So he did improvise. And he had fun doing it. And I had fun just giving him musical ideas, and he was taking them and running with them, because he was so good at what he did.
Yeah, that's what
Andrea Kidd.
Andrea does, mm-hmm. Yeah. She does, lays down her stuff, and then sends it up to Montana.
Yeah. That was really interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And we heard that the cut is from the CD Shalico.
Right.
And we'll just give you a quick moment to let you know Joe Harrington's website, which is where you can also get the things that we're talking about tonight. Joe, what's your web address?
JoeHarrington.com. That's Harrington with an E, HERRINGTON.
And the CD that we're the CD we just played is available there.
Shalico, right?
Yeah, Shalico.
Yeah, Shalico. And on the website is my performance schedule, as well as the products that I have.
Right.
Cool. We need to take a minute and sell some airtime here.
Okay.
So next, I just want to announce that these are still recorded ads, but next week we're going live. So just enjoy. What am I doing here? Oh, I know what I'm doing. We're going to add one. Here we go.
Hey, Jim Christina here for all you LTL shippers. Are you tired of your freight being reclassified? Tired of calling several freight companies for the best rates? Of course, and then they reclass you and there go your rates anyway. Then Target Freight Management has a solution for you. Their customized transportation management system protects all of their clients from situations just like yours. So if you're currently shipping a density-based product, you need to call Target Freight today. Target Freight is currently saving their clients between 15 and 20% of their freight costs. That's a huge savings to anyone. They'll even do a free cost analysis of your current freight to see if you're a good fit for their program, and not everyone is. The kicker is, Target Freight is paid only on the contingency they can save you money. Call Target Freight today and just see what they can do for your company. Target Freight Management, 888-653-1323. That's 888-653-1323. Or go to www.targetfmi.com on the web.
And we're back. And Target Freight has asked me to tell you guys that if you call them and you give them the information that you heard this ad on the writer's block, they got a little something special for you. So give them a call. They're really great people to work with. And I've been working with them now for 8 years, so they're fun. Okay, let's get into some fiction that we have going on here. Joe Harrington wrote a book called Tekoa. And Bobby Jean brought it to me in the studio one night, and I just wanted to read it. So I took it home, and I opened it up, and that was it. The book never closed until I finished it. It is such a wonderful, wonderful story. And if you never want to read another book about friendship and loyalty and everything that goes along with it, you want to read Tekoa. And I'm going to let Joe explain a little bit where it came from and where the meanings of the words came from, because there's some strange words in this book. But everybody's reading it goes, well, how do you pronounce that?
Well, some of the character names and some of the place names I, of course, made up.
Right.
But the Tekoans and the Nephilim were really civilizations that came out of the Old Testament. And so when I discovered those and the fact that those civilizations just kind of disappeared, I thought, whoa, I could do something with that. And so I latched onto those names because I liked the sound of the names, and they worked well within the story that I had there.
There are two main characters, Shelby Ferris and David Carson. These two young men, tell us about these guys.
I have to sort of give you a little secret there. When I was growing up, from the 10th grade on, I had a best buddy named David Kerr. And we tromped all over the Big Bend country of Texas. That's rugged country. There's still a lot of country there that I do believe no white man has ever put a foot on. We found some of those amazing places. It's a tough wilderness. But we were there looking for dinosaur tracks and caves and meteorites, and we loved science and we loved tromping all over that countryside, and we must have picked up a ton of fossils over our adventures. But we did all of that stuff together. We both loved science, and we both loved agriculture, and we were in Future Farmers of America together. And so as I began to tell this story and try to decide what characters I wanted to use, I kept coming back to so many of the adventures that we had together. Mm-hmm. We did spelunking together. We got into caves. So many of the events in the book were really taken from things that we did and things that my brothers did. For example, there is a story within one of the chapters when we're inside of a cave and we are going through a very, very confined space. And David gets down in this space and gets caught in it. And in order to get out of it, he had to take his pants off, and then we pulled him through. It was that tight of a place. Well, that actually happened to my brother. I had a brother that would do things like that. He would go down in these places, and he got stuck in a cave one time, and he had to remove his pants before we could get him through that hole. And so
there's a visual.
Yeah.
There are so many of the little events that took that are throughout the novel that really come from real life.
Well, and there are two guys that just have individual personalities but get along so very well and are so supportive of each other.
Right.
And they're also kind of MacGyver-like. They can do more with dental floss and duct tape and toilet paper,
Yeah, one guy's a ranch guy and the other guy's a city boy.
Yeah. But we had, and that's true. That's the way it was. And and David did have he learned to really love agriculture. And he ended up being a telephone repairman, but he loved agriculture. Mm-hmm. And so the characters really came from our friendship and the things that we did, but obviously there, it got into the fiction area too.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, because you can't tell a story like that and have it all true. There's no way. But it is based, I call it a science fiction based on science fact.
I was just waiting for the volcano to blow, and it never did.
Well, in the second, in the sequel, which I do have three chapters to.
Oh, I was been wondering.
I ran out of time, and I just haven't been able to finish that. But I did, I brought the female character, Vishti, to the front, and the story actually begins with that volcano erupting and her. Of course, David and Shelby,
they were totally in love.
But they're not back yet.
Yeah.
And so this all happens in their absence. And she's sort of taking charge. And that's about as far as I've got. But I feel pretty good about where that thing can go if I can ever get back to it.
I liked Vishti.
Oh, yes.
I thought she was hot.
Yeah. Well, yes. Yes. We have some really nasty, you know, characters in this book.
Yeah.
It's very clearly a good and, you know, good and evil. But these two young men, they, you know, when I read the book, I thought a lot about Lewis and Clark or, you know, other adventurers and what it is to go on a journey like this and what it is to deal with the wilderness, and they find themselves they find themselves in an alternative universe, so to speak.
Yeah, it's almost like a parallel universe.
Yeah. Yes. And there's things they recognize, and English is spoken, and
right,
you know,
right.
Tell us about, it was so fun how you introduced Nikola Tesla.
I was always fascinated with that character, mostly because I loved high voltage electricity. When I was a senior in high school, my dad finally said, "You can't do this stuff in the house anymore." So he helped me build a little house out in the back, and it was 8x8. I filled it full of radio gear, and I filled it full of high voltage gear. My brothers would laugh because they would say, you know, it would look out the window in the evening, and that little shack would just be glowing blue arcs through the wood, you know, because it wasn't, I mean, it was just a shack that we put together, and it just had wood slats in it. There was no tar paper, and so you would see that blue arc glow coming through the boards. And when I got into my radio stuff, you know, I told Dad, I said, "Dad, I need to use 2 acres in the back to put up some antennas." And he said, "Go for it. Just keep it away from the house." And so he was very supportive. Anything that I was one of the oldest of five boys, and no matter what our interests were, he would try to help us in every way we could. When he found out that I enjoyed radios and fixing things, he would just drag home everything in the world for me to fix, and I learned an awful lot doing that. And I got into radio in a big way, and so out in that shack, one of the things that I built was a lightning detector. I thought it was so cool that I could take an old television set and hook my antenna arrays up to the horizontal or vertical coils of that television set, and I could see my little blip move to where the lightning was hitting. So I got the great idea of moving that into my little Volkswagen Bug. So I took out the front seat. It kind of had a little bit of effect on my love life because my dates had to sit in the back seat, and with my gear was right there in the beside me. But I had this really, great date coming up, and my brother Mike, he always ribbed about this. He says, "Joe, you got to take that stuff out. You can't have her sitting back there." I said, "Okay, I'll take the lightning detector out." So I took the lightning detector out, but she still had to sit in the back seat. So all the antenna cables are laying on the floor, she lived in another town, so it's 30 miles away. And I went to get her. We're coming back in this thunderstorm. A good old Texas rip snorter came through. I said, we got to enjoy this. So I took her up on top of the mountain. There was a big radio antenna on top of this mountain. I said, "Let's go up there and watch the lightning strike," because I knew lightning was going to strike that tower. Well, she was a little apprehensive about that. We got we climbed up. We were in the car. We got up to the top of that mountain, and we're sitting there. And I'm just in great anticipation of this lightning coming. And suddenly, everything started humming around us. You know, the guy wires were just going. And she started crying, and her blonde hair started to fly. And then all of a sudden, all the antenna cables on the floor started arcing. And she, you know, a Volkswagen's not very big anyway, and she was in the back seat. She got in the back part of the back seat, and she said, "Get me home right now." And so we had to leave before the lightning struck. And
first date?
Last date.
You can see what a great storyteller. You know, great storyteller.
Oh, my God, that's funny.
It's adventures like that, yeah, that David and I had. Now, see, David would have been right there with me. He would have been doing the same things. And so that's the kind of adventures that we had, and that's where the stories came from.
Yeah.
Somehow I think I got away from your original question.
I don't even remember what it was. The story was Tesla.
I was just asking.
Okay, so getting back to Nikola Tesla. I'm sorry. So anyway, I built Tesla coils and all kinds of things. In fact, I built a humongous Tesla coil to kill flies with. I thought it was the greatest thing in the world. And, but I admired Tesla. I really did. And I tried to mimic many of his experiments, many of which people today don't know how he did.
Right.
I mean, he was quite a guy. But the story, there were so many stories about him lighting lights from a long distance away over the air and shooting lightning bolts from his hands and all that kind of stuff. I just was thirsty for anything that Tesla did, and I was fascinated because I loved that stuff. Mm-hmm. And so when the idea of Wardenclyffe kind of haunted me a little bit, so I thought, wouldn't it be great if that was actually over in Toccoa? That's where he really did his original experiments and things like that. So I put it there, and at first I thought, this is a wild and crazy idea, but the more I worked on it, the more I thought, no, I really like this. This makes sense to do this. And so then I was able to, once I placed that story in there, then I was able to carry out some of those experiments that he did,
mm-hmm,
in that place. Does that sort of answer your question?
Yes, it does. And, you know, there are stories within the stories, like you're saying. Mm-hmm. As I think about it, there's a scene where I think it's Shelby is going through a thicket. It's a story that goes on actually for quite a few pages. It's a chase. I mean, it is a great chase, and he does remarkable things to get away from his pursuers.
Right.
And he goes through this thicket, and I felt like I was in that thicket trying to understand the challenges of getting through that thicket. And then there's a white buffalo.
Yes.
And then he rides out on this white buffalo.
Right.
And I thought, there's a story. Like, if that was all one told, was the pursuer and the thicket and coming out on a buffalo, it was mesmerizing.
A lot of those stories come from... Well, I'm sort of a method writer, and I was in a thicket like that, and so I was able to describe it because I've been there, and so many of the things, like for example, the moments of thirst and hunger and things like that, I went out and I got as hungry as I could and as thirsty as I could. I got as miserable as I possibly could, so that I could really write it, from a true, mm-hmm, point of view,
mm-hmm,
and so. So many of the adventures I either tried or did in one way or another. And then the white buffalo thing was something that Louis L'Amour passed. He just kind of skimmed over it in a story at one point. And I was fascinated by the fact that the Indians had really had great admiration for the white buffalo. And I thought, I think I'll do something with that. And so I did. And it provided a great escape. Because only a buffalo could have done that.
He dumps all his stuff.
Oh, it just goes on.
It's like I had visions of Shelby coming out on the white buffalo, naked with no shoes,
And he jumps down, you know, he figures out how to, okay, this is what I'm going to have to do to get on him. I'm going to have to get from this other point. And they're very smart, these two young men.
Yep.
It's an adventure story. It's on so many different layers of entertaining.
It's one of the better books I've read in a long time.
Well, I want it to be educational, too. That's why there's a glossary in the back of the book. Because I want young people to be fascinated with science. And so this has got a lot of teasers in it, because the kinds of things that happen follow the laws of physics. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, today's kids don't have much fascination with science, and I really wanted that to be something that would say, you know, science can be fun.
Yeah. It's not a lot of imagination anymore.
Well, I remember when the big deal at Christmas was to get a chemistry set.
Oh, no, my mother would never let me have a chemistry set.
You know, my sister got a chemistry set.
I would have blown up the house.
You know, that was, wow, a chemistry set. That was, you know, I don't know how many kids get chemistry sets for Christmas anymore.
I got to steal 30 more seconds from you, so...
We'll be back.
We'll be back.
Hey, Jim Christina here for TFM Truckload, a division of Target Freight Management. TFM is here to help you with all of your truckload and railroad shipping needs. So if you want a reputable company who is going to work hard to find you the best rates while maintaining award-winning service, TFM is who you need to call. When TFM Truckload books a truck for your company, it shows up 100% of the time. If you want a reliable truckload broker, then you need to call TFM Truckload today, toll-free at 1-844-653-7789. That's 844-653-7789. Or catch them at www.targetfmi.com on the web.
And we are back in studio with Joe Harrington. And if you want to call and talk with Joe, number here is 818-602-4929. That's 818-602-4929. And along with Target Freight Management, they'd like to let you know that if you call them and let them know that you heard their name on the Writer's Block, they have a little something for you. So you may want to give them a call and let them see that. Also, we are brought to you by Black Dog Publishing and Simi Valley, and by Out West Boutique and Cultural Center in Newhall. And Joe, I have the question I really want to do is the motivation what got you motivated to write the book Tekoa?
My Boy Scouts. I had told them a story. Let me back up even further than that. Growing up in West Texas, we had this legend that was going around about the Marfalites. The Marfalites occur between Alpine and Marfa, Texas, and I mean, even the Indians talked about them, mm-hmm. and they weren't explained. Nobody knew what they were, but there were a lot of ideas about what they were. So I decided to tell my boys about the Marfalites, and then at the end of that, they just wanted to know more and more and more, and that's when one of the parents said, you need to write this down, because I told them about the Marfalites, and I told them about David and I going down there and trying to find them and trying to figure out what they were. And that became the seed for this. And then when I found
people, you know what? We have a phone call.
Oh, we do?
Yeah. You know who it's from?
No. Who?
The Bookie.
Ah, Jerry.
Hi, Bookie.
It's me. I just wanted to ask Joe, was I your date that night? I remember sitting in the back of a car.
Did you remember your hair, you know, getting that electricity and going up all over the place?
I did.
Wow.
My goodness.
I guess we'll be having a conversation when I get home.
Somehow that slipped my memory.
You had to know I would do this.
Of course we knew that.
Nice to meet you, Joe. You're doing great. I love to listen to your stories, and I'm just going to say, Joe, call me when you have that lightning rod thing going on.
Okay.
Thank you, dear.
Bye-bye, guys.
Good
Bye.
To talk to you. See Bye. Ya.
Bye.
And that's the Bookie. That's who you sent all your information to. Oh, my God.
Where were we?
Motivation behind
writing the book.
Okay, yeah. So then I found out that, you know, there was a lot of interest in this particular story. The uh-huh. boys were interested, the parents were interested, and the more I looked at that story, I thought, you know, there is the seed here to go a lot further with it. So then I decided that, you know, I'll just give this a shot. And so I did. That story just got bigger and bigger. And then I worked on that story, for that book, for a couple of years, mostly because I was trying to live those events as much as I possibly could. I've got a cousin who is a great mystery writer, David Lindsay. And, you know, I picked up a lot of things from him. And one of the things was, he said, you know, you need to know what you're writing about. You can always tell when you have a writer who doesn't know what he's writing about. And I thought, you know, I'm going to know what I'm writing about. And fortunately, most of the things I'd already done. But there were some things that I had not done. I had not ever been near starvation. And, you know, I'd never been that close to dying of thirst. I wanted to know what it felt like. My dad didn't like the idea, but, you know, when I told my family what I was doing on some of these things, but I felt like it gave me a better ability to describe what was going on to have actually lived it and done it. So anyway, that story just grew. And once it got started, I fell in love with my characters. I fell in love with the story, and I had a hard time stopping it, let me tell you.
Yeah. Yeah, I find that too. It's really hard for me to stop sometimes. This one, I was really glad it was over, but some of them, they could have gone on forever.
The books you've written, you're talking
about. Yeah.
Right.
We have a question that we ask all of the writers. Let me preface that by saying that when we bring somebody in or we talk to them on the phone, our main goal is to find out what motivates them as a writer. What gets them fired up, what makes them get up in the morning and picking up a pen, or in Troy's instance, laying upside down and writing it with a big pen.
Broken back.
I don't know if you ever heard that story of Troy Andrew Smith.
No.
Oh, my God. You ought to ask him about it sometime.
Yeah,
it's hilarious.
Great story.
But we like to know what motivates writers. So what motivates you as a writer? And then there's another question attached to it.
Well, part of what motivates me as a writer now, as opposed to when I started, when I started, it was mostly out of curiosity and interest. And I never thought I'd do anything like that. In fact, I just did a little aside here. I'm good at asides. I'm sorry.
Well, you're a storyteller.
Don't apologize.
I did a show for the Vintage Radio Convention in Fort Worth last weekend. And when I was there, the director of the event, we got to visiting, and he said, my wife is from your hometown. He introduced me to his wife, and we found out very quickly she was my English teacher in high school.
I thought maybe she was the blonde-headed chick with the hair.
No, she was my English teacher.
Oh, my gosh.
And I thought, oh, my goodness, wonder what she would think if she had heard what I did to the English language that night. Because I took a lot of liberties in my stories and in my poetry. I take a lot of liberties with the English language. I mean, that's just what you do.
Well, you have to.
But I'm comforted to know that she said, oh, her mother would have loved her. Her mother died a couple of years ago. But I've often thought, I've had a couple of English teachers that I would really like to have hear my stuff now, because when I was in their class, they had no clue that I was, if anything, I was the little science freak. I never had anything to do with literature. So, anyway, so I got off again on another aside. I'm sorry about that.
It's okay.
It happens.
And your question was?
I forgot. Well, the one question we ask everybody is, because the name of our program is The Writer's Block.
Right.
And have you ever had writer's block?
Everybody gets writer's block, but I continue to write whether I know that it's going to go in the work or not. I keep on writing because it always gets me where I need to be. It gets me back on track again. And I do the same thing. To me, when I'm writing, it's like brainstorming. Nothing is ever a bad idea. You write it down, you put it on a card, and you set it aside. You may not use it now, but at some point you will, or you might. And because when those things come into your mind, they come into your mind for a reason, and you don't ever want to throw them away. And if you just sit there and ignorantly say, "Oh, I'll remember that," you've made a big mistake, because you won't remember that. And so I do that all through life. You know, if when I hear something or see something, I think, "Wow," I write it down. I keep a in my iPhone. I keep a note page, writing notes. And it's everything that I hear or see that I think I might find of interest at some point. And so when I do write, I like to go back to that kind of stuff. But now, going back to what your question was, what motivates me now? What motivates me now is a civilization, a culture that has fallen apart. And I feel like somebody has got to do something, to say, no, this is not the way you're supposed to live. This is not the way you're supposed to act. And through my stories and my poetry, I try to pull people back into the where we should really be going.
Mm-hmm.
And the beauty of stories is that you can do that without poking your finger in somebody's face and saying, no, you can't do that,
or right,
you shouldn't do that.
Right.
Because with stories, all of a sudden, you've got a listener that's listening, and your story is going by like on a conveyor belt. And they can just reach up and grab off of that conveyor belt the things that apply to them. It's not threatening in any way, because it's about somebody else. But at the same time, on a subconscious level, it's saying something to their heart.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what motivates me now, trying to get a message out without that message being a finger in their face.
There you go. Well, we've got another cut here from you, and it's called The Greatest Generation?
Yes, sir.
And this is, once again, Joe Harrington.
You want to set that up, or you want to tell about it
afterwards? You can tell about it afterwards, because we're not going to be able to run the whole thing, because we're going to be out of time, but we'll run a lot of it. So.
Oh, okay.
And it's we'll go ahead and set it up first.
Well, no, I'd rather you play it. I
can do that. And this is The Greatest Generation.
I pulled in tired and weary, desperate to make a stop, needing just what I knew I'd find at Katie's Coffee Shop. On a stool at the end of the counter, an old man was sitting there in a denim jacket, old blue jeans, boots, and straggly hair. I made a quick assessment, had him pegged a bum. No doubt he's begging coffee and whatever else might come. Probably a no-account drifter who'd long outlived his use. Bet he'd bummed for 40 years and had some lame excuse. But his eyes were closed and restful like he's 100 miles away. A remembering look marked his face with some distant better day. I sat down, slow and easy, not wanting to intrude or make a noise to spoil his thoughts and come across as rude. Now, I'd thought him old and paltry, a victim of neglect. But then I saw his buckle and leaned in with new respect. He wore a silver trophy belt, scuffed and scratched with time. Said Prescott All-Around Champion, 1949. Wow, those things don't come easy and they sure don't fade with time. He must have been something else, young and in his prime. He stirred then and sensed my presence, and his hat fell to the floor. And there, a pin marked Lucky Forward, 1944. Now, I'd been impressed, but now I stunned and stared in total awe. This old man's a legend, not the bum I thought I saw. I said, "You? Spearhead? Patton? You must have been a kid." He quipped, "I should smile. You won't believe the things I did. Fought with him in Belgium. That's how come my leg's lame." Yeah, me and old Blood and Guts, son, he knew me by my name. Oh, I pelted him with questions about things I'd heard and read, and you know it pleased him some to note my interest. So he grinned, and then he said I cowboyed all West Texas till that day in 41. All us cowboys rode to town. Signed up is what we done. We were six best buddies, still gullible and green, but we were men in those days, sonny, even at 17. We went to war with Patton, broke the Battle of the Bulge. I lost those pards at Ardennes in ways I can't.
And we're back in, and unfortunately we don't have time to finish this up, but wow, that is really something. You want to give us a little bit of backstory on that?
Well, my daddy was in World War II, and he was in the Korean War. And I've known a lot of a lot of old veterans that have just basically been forgotten. And I've had a lot of concern, a lot of compassion for these men and women. And 1 year after Albuquerque, I'd finished the show in Albuquerque, and I went to get the train station to catch a train back here. And there was an old man sitting in the train station. And he was kind of in everybody's way.
Mm-hmm.
And my first impression was, this is an old bum. But like the story indicated, I saw his belt buckle. And so mm-hmm. I sat down and started talking to him. And I quickly realized what a mistake I had made. This was an amazing man. And I thought, you know, this is a story that needs to be told, because we run across people every day that we just brush off.
Right, they don't, just write them off.
Yeah, they just don't fit into our comfort zone.
Mm-hmm.
And the amazing people that we don't get the opportunity to talk to because we never ask. We never want to find out. And so that's kind of where this got started. And I found a lot of... I've continued to do this piece. And mm-hmm. it seems to touch a lot of hearts, because everybody's got a grandfather or a father or an uncle.
Especially if you're a veteran.
Yeah.
Yeah, I get that. My father was a veteran, my uncles and...
Mm-hmm. My dad.
My brother.
Yeah.
Interesting. Just wonderful. I hate to end it here, but we have to.
Yeah.
give us a real quick rundown of where we can get a hold of you, Joe. Your website is, of course, joeharrington.com.
Joeharrington.com, yes, sir.
And your email?
Well, tophand@joeharrington.com.
Oh, there you go. That's easy enough. Where are you going to be next? Besides China.
My life is not my own until July,
mm-hmm.
When I finish in China. And then, actually, when I come back from China, the first show I have is for Bobby Jean. Mm-hmm. We're doing the Story Masters, and I'm doing that with Junie Fisher out of the Nashville area.
There you go.
And mm-hmm. that'll be fun. And then immediately after that, in September, I got a call just this past week to do the biggest storytelling festival in the world. And so that's the Timpanogos Festival in Orem, Utah. And so I'm really excited about that.
Hmm. Wow.
It's been fun.
It's been an honor having you here, I have to tell you. You shut me up, and that's really hard to do. And we thank you for coming on with us, and I hope someday you can come back next year.
Well, we should book him for, you know, October.
Yeah.
Jerry, if you're listening.
Yeah, Jerry, if you're listening, book Joe back in October, would you?
Yeah.
And and you got, you're here with, now we're here, you know what, for the life of me, I cannot remember the name of the gal that's on with us next week.
I think
week.
Is it Heidi Gilbert?
Heidi Gilbert. She's driving down from Sacramento area to be with us in studio.
Great.
She writes under a nom de plume. I've got her book. I haven't started it yet, but.
We'll be ready.
Yeah, 350 pages.
Looking forward to it.
The following week, of course, we have our first annual Christmas show, which will feature everybody that has anything to do with the writer's block. And it'll be Jim and Bobby and myself and the bookie and Russ.
And Russ.
And we're just going to chat. So if you'd like to call in and talk to us then, we'll give you the numbers that night. That's on the 17th. With that being said, Joe, thank you again for joining us. It's been a wonderful time. Great to have you back, Bobby. Jim, good to see you. And we are out of here. Mm-hmm.